Excited for us to start this new series in the book of Jonah this morning. Jonah is a vivid, expansive, true narrative that has an awful lot going on in it. Geographically, it covers the known world, basically. Tarshish probably was in the eastern side of Spain. Nineveh on the east is pretty much that's the known world during that time. But it's also a very unique book, because it's the only place in the Bible where a non-false prophet disobeys God. It's the only place where someone who should have obeyed God, who you would have expected to have followed, didn't. And I actually wanted to kind of figure out, do other religions have, in their books, have a similar thing? Because it's really unique. I think it's helpful for today's culture because it's surprising, it's shocking. It's not just like the law says, do this and you'll live. It's like, here's Jonah turning away from God. Jonah should have been fleeing for his presence, but he fleed away from his presence. And so Jonah, I think, is particularly helpful to help us to think about who God is. But also, I think it's helpful to diagnose the particular spiritual ailments that religious people have. We're not going to get into Jonah's whole story today, but there's a lot going on in Jonah that we can think, oh, gosh, are there seeds of that in my heart? So I'm excited for us to spend time in this book of Jonah. We're going to just get going in the. So it's a short book. It's sort of like an episode of Iron Chef. You only have an hour, but out come all these like six or seven dishes. There's all kinds of themes and ideas that are really helpful to explore in this short book. So this morning we're just going to start off by saying, who is the God of the Bible? Who is this God who Jonah is fleeing from, and what is he all about? Reagan Fernandez is going to come and read our passage for us. So before we dive in, I'd like to just address, I think there's sort of an elephant in the room, and maybe there's a piece of cake also in the room. So you'll notice our second to fifth graders are here with us this morning. And so for them, a lot of you have grown up talking about Jonah and the big fish, right? You've drawn pictures of it. You've read about it for years and years. You're experts in Jonah and the big fish. And so for you, it's kind of perhaps exciting, hopefully, that you're like, oh, and now I get to actually hear about this book in the adult service. So for you, I think this morning, we're not going to talk about the big fish this morning, but we're going to talk about who is the God who sent the big fish, right? So we're going to try to figure out who is this God who would act in this way. For others of you, perhaps the elephant in the room is, you're thinking, or maybe you're thinking in your heart saying, but you don't really believe that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Although the text says big fish. But the question, some of you are probably in the, whether you verbalize it or not, you're thinking, well, we can't really believe that happened, can we? And so to respond to that, just say there's two sub-questions to that. There's one is, well, what is the genre of this book? Like, what does the author of Jonah want us to believe? And there's some debate about that, but for the most part, I think the clues of the genre point to this is an historical narrative, a narrative prophetic book. And so I think the author's pointing us towards the view that this actually happened. But then on another level, we have to say philosophically, could it have happened? Do we even allow the possibility for miracles to take place? And on that level, the fish is actually not the biggest problem, because there's lots of little miracles that occur in this book, but throughout the Bible, there's lots of big miracles that occur. So, I mean, Jonah's not unique in that sense. I mean, if you want to, you might as well go to the ultimate issues of, in the Old Testament, did the Exodus happen? Did God come and part the Red Sea, and did they escape from Egypt in that way? If you deny that, if you take that out, pretty much the Old Testament all kind of falls apart. I mean, the Exodus is talked about 120 times, I believe, in the Old Testament after Exodus. And so it's a crucial, critical piece. And then the New Testament, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, if the resurrection didn't actually happen, Paul says, you know, forget it. It's all over. There's nothing to this faith. And so, so actually, don't worry about the fish. You should worry about the bigger miracles, if that's an issue for you, of the Exodus and then ultimately of the resurrection. Did that happen? That's where we should put our attention. But So let's, with that said, let's dive in and see who is. So the 2 points here are, there's gods all around, but who is the God of the Bible? And then we'll look at, there are faiths all around, and storms show us ours. So you'll notice from this passage that this is a pluralistic environment, right? There's the sailors have all different gods, right? The captain says, call upon your God. The sailors, it's a pluralistic environment. There's all these different gods going on. And the whole reason the book starts is that God is concerned about what's happening in Assyria. Well, Assyria had their own religious system. And so it's kind of interesting. This isn't just a Jerusalem-based book. It's a book about the whole world, and it's a book about lots of different gods and faiths. But the book wants us to focus in on, and its opening kind of salvo is to say, let's look at who the God of the Bible is. Let's look at who the God is who's calling Jonah. So I have three couplets I want to look at, and then a fourth couplet later on. So first, the God of the Bible is personal. If you look at verse 1, now the word of the Lord came to Jonah. So God is a God, the God of the Bible is the God who speaks, right? He speaks his word. He's personal. It says the word of the Lord. The word for God underneath the word Lord is Yahweh. Yahweh is the covenant-making God, the God who actually interacts with human beings and creates a relationship with them. So as opposed, other options might be that something of that God is not personal, but that God is just a force, right? That's one of the options out there. We might call it pantheism, but so for some people, God is just some force or some power out there. But the God of the Bible is personal. So kids, what does that mean? It means that you can know who God is, that God is knowable, that he speaks, that he's personal. Or rather, we might even say you're a person because God is personal, right? Because God created you in his image. I was watching my David for the most of yesterday, and we're interacting all these different things. And at one point, I think I said, oh, you might be a good climber because he loves to climb things. And he said, I'm not a climber, I'm a person. I'm like, where did that come from? Where did you pick up that word? But it's but God might say the same thing. We might say, oh, I believe in some force in nature or force out there. But God said, no, I'm personal. I'm one God in three persons. So God is personal, but God is also present. He's at work in this world, right? He speaks to Jonah, arise and go to Nineveh. He knows what's going on in Nineveh, that there's a reason to send him there. And so that as well is important because there's another view of who God might be, of that God started everything moving in this world, and then he left and took off and went on vacation. Right? It's called, that the name for that is deism, right? That God set everything in motion, but he's not here now. He doesn't interact in nature. He doesn't speak to us. He's just let us be to get along as best as we can. But the book of Jonah is saying, no, that's not the God of the Bible either. The God of the Bible is present and active at work in the here. So kids, what does that mean? It means God sees you. It means God hears your prayers. It means God's interested in you and in your world. It means he's at work here. I think this is my last David story this morning. But for Christmas, we asked David, what do you want for Christmas? And he was very specific. He said, I want Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man. And so we picked up, we said, well, The Dark Knight, that's not a good idea. And so let's go with Spider-Man, okay? So we gave him a little 14-inch Spider-Man, and it was great until some other toy came along, and we still can't find it. We don't know where it is in the house. And so I asked David the other day, where's your Spider-Man? He said, oh, it's gone, which it's no more, which didn't encourage me as far as like responsibility with toys and the whole concept. So that's a deeper problem. But it's sort of like the deist says, where's God? He's gone. Right, I don't know where he went. Maybe he got thrown out with the trash, but he's not here anymore. But the Bible is saying, no, he's here. He's active. He's present. He's engaged with us. All right, so that's personal and he's present. But God also, now the next couplet is God is just and gracious. If you look at verse 2 and 3, so arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me. God has seen what's gone on in Assyria, and he's aware of their evil, and it's violating his justice. He's saying, what's going on in Nineveh shall not happen. It is wrong. I will not allow this to take place anymore. And so that's the whole reason this book starts. He sends Jonah to call out against Nineveh. Now, with the kids in the audience, I almost couldn't read to you the historical annals of what Nineveh did. I mean, they're on the line of any dictator, any atrocity in the 20th, 21st century. I mean, it's horrible, grotesque, butcherous, brutal stuff that Nineveh was doing. So it's not just these people weren't honoring God the way they should. I mean, this, when it says the evil came up against them, historically, we can generate lots of evil that was coming out of the Assyrian Empire. So God's justice is concerned about global corporate evil and atrocities, but he's also concerned about personal evil, right? Verse 3. So God says, arise, go to Nineveh, the great city. And it says, but Jonah arose, same word, he arises, but he flees to Tarshish from the presence of God. Right? This prophet who should have been fleeing to God is fleeing away from him. And so in a sense, we get a great definition of personal sin here, kids. Right? What is sin? It's fleeing away from God's presence. It's rejecting God's presence. It's saying, I can do better. I don't want your presence. I'm going the other direction. Right? That's what sin is. And so God's concerned about, so verse 3, right? He flees the other, Jonah flees the other way. Verse 4, but God hurls a great wind upon the sea. So God isn't going to let go of that injustice either, that personal injustice of Jonah against God. That drives the narrative forward. So God is a God of justice. And justice is really popular today in our culture, right? That's a value that culturally has a lot of high marks. It's interesting, though, we don't really like judgment. Right? We like justice as a culture, but we don't like judgment. The two kind of have to go together at some point, right? There was only justice after the Holocaust when they had the Nuremberg trials to actually say, to prove you are guilty of all this and you're being punished for it. So justice eventually requires judgment. So God is a God of justice, and kids, I think you have, kids have life, are experience, they experience injustice immediately in life almost, right? Kids, can you remember back to when you were like 1 or 2 or 3? What would you say when you're playing with your brand new truck and a friend or someone in school or your brother or sister comes along and grabs it, takes it away from you? We're born with justice alarms, right? Immediately, it's like, ah! You're screaming, mom, dad. You're saying it's not fair. It's mine, right? We've all experienced, even just from the earliest years of life, we experience injustice, and the alarms go off about it. Well, I think the Bible would say that comes from the fact that God is a God of justice. But God's also a God of graciousness, that God is gracious here. Because when he says, call out against Nineveh, he's not saying, call out because I am bringing judgment right now. He's saying, call out so that you have an opportunity to avoid judgment, so that you have an opportunity to turn around, to change your ways and come back to God, which is what we'll see later on actually happens. And so that verse 2, when it says to call out against it, it's got judgment in the background, but it's actually graciousness to say, will you respond to me so that I my justice doesn't have to bring judgment. I don't want to bring judgment. But a world without that justice is untenable, and I won't allow it to happen. And then even with Jonah, right? If we just put ourselves in the picture of God, right? And we call Jonah, go proclaim, call out the judgment, justice against Nineveh. And Jonah turns around and flees and goes the exact opposite direction, trying to get away from you. I mean, God could have been just like, what's wrong with you? And or he could have been like, okay, fine. You don't want anything to do with me? I'll just let you go languish over on the coast of Spain. But it's actually God insists on going after Jonah. I think that's an aspect of his active graciousness, right? That he sends this, verse 4, he hurls a great wind, right? He's at work to pull Jonah back. And that's actually this theme that goes throughout the whole book. God's constant, it's almost, the book in one sense is, it's a battle back and forth between Jonah and God. But it's God's graciousness that puts God in the battle, that says, I will wrestle you. I won't either dismiss you and forget about you and just say, all right, are you someone else? Because I care about you, and I won't just snuff you out. So God's justice and his graciousness are held together. And I think, actually, I think the Bible has a really bad rap on those two themes. I think the Bible holds together justice and graciousness in a way that we actually personally want and we personally need, right? We refuse to say, let's get rid of justice. Let's just, you know, bad things happen to bad people. Oh, well, that's just the way it happens. I mean, sorry, but that grates against us. We want a world where there's justice. And yet we also want a world where punishment just doesn't come down immediately and choose, here's the good people and here's the bad people. So I think the Bible is actually very rich in how it holds together God's justice and God's graciousness. I think it turns out the way that, pretty close to what we might design ourselves, because we wouldn't want to give up either one of those two. So God's just and he's gracious. The third couplet is, God's powerful, and yet he is calling, yet he calls people. So if you look at how is God at work here, he's at work in the sea, right? He can command the sea, to all the weather to change. That he hurls this active, strong word, hurls a great wind upon the sea in verse 4. In verse 7, God determines the lot. They cast lots to see who's responsible for this. And so the lot falls on Jonah. That's God's doing. Jonah even himself testifies to who God is and his power in verse 9. He says, I'm a Hebrew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. And God made all this in the first place. So, and then actually in verse 15, God's able to bring a calm upon the sea. So we see God is greatly powerful in a variety of areas outside of Jerusalem and Judea. So God's not just, his power isn't limited to certain areas, which was a common belief of gods in the ancient world. But he is at work all over the place. And yet, he calls Jonah to do his work. Right? He doesn't just come and visit Nineveh himself. He calls Jonah to be involved in his work. And so here's this God with great, immense power who still chooses to use his people. And it's shocking that he wants to use Jonah, but Jonah runs the other way. And so there's this tension there of that God is powerful enough to deal with all of our issues, and yet he's gracious, he's wise enough, he's surprising enough, he wants to use his people in the midst of working his power out, so that we actually get to experience that power and that work in new ways. So we get this picture of who is the God of the Bible. He's personal and he's present. He's just and he's gracious. He's powerful and he also calls his people to do things. I'd like to be bold and suggest this is a great picture of who God is. That if you were to describe who you wanted God to be, what else would you add? I mean, we'll add a little bit more later, but I think this is a wonderful, rich picture of who the God of the Bible is, who's the God is that calls us to respond to Him. And I think it's also a great foil for those who might say, well, I believe in God, to say, well, which God do you believe in? Right? Because the God of the Bible is different from all these gods on the boat that these sailors are calling out to. The God of the Bible is different from the God of Assyria, or the gods of Assyria, the polytheistic environment. So when someone says, oh, I believe in God, it's like, well, maybe the next question is, well, which God do you believe in? Or what is your God like? Right? Because it's an open question it's easy to say, I believe in God, but I want us to spend some time with, here's the God of the Bible. Here's the God of Scriptures who is unique and personal and powerful and at work amongst us. There are many options if you want to believe in God, but there is only one God of the Scriptures. So you might say, but you might object and say, well, you know, Ross, you know, okay, God's great and stuff, but what about the mariners, right? What about God? Would God put these sailors through this big storm? And what about the cargo, all that economic benefit? I mean, what? Maybe they had an economic crisis too, and it was all thrown into the water. Is that really fair of God as well? But I like to say, actually, that so there's lots, these sailors all had different faiths, but it's the storm actually that actually shows them what they believe. Because you can imagine these sailors are on the way, they're thinking, oh, finally I got a good job, I'm going to make some really good money taking cargo from Joppa to Tarshish, it's going to be a great time. We're out in the open sea. We got all this great ahi tuna to eat. This is a great time. And all of a sudden, this storm comes, and they're all calling out to their God. They are afraid, right? Verse 5, the mariners are afraid, and they call out to their God, to their gods. I think that's similar to what happens with us, right? That they're just cruising along. Life is calm. Life is good. And they don't think about their God. They don't think about their worldview. They don't think about what their faith actually means until the storm comes. So by sending the storm, God is actually doing a good thing in terms of forcing the sailors to start to think through, what is it I believe? How do I put together the spiritual, physical nature of this world? So I think God sending storms actually it's very beneficial to us as well, because we tend to fall back into just cruise mode, right? When things are going well, we enjoy life and we try to have a peaceful, nice family life and we look for entertainment and stuff. But when storms come, we are pressed to think about, well, what do I actually believe? I think everyone has a configuration of what the world's all about. It's storms that force us to work, to look to it, to test it, and to see if it actually holds up. And I do say this with sympathy and compassion, because probably all of us are either just starting a storm, or in the midst of one, or just coming out of one. And obviously, there's right in our midst, there's people going through storms, and it's harsh and it's hard and it's sad and it's full of grief, and yet it is what it forces us. It's one of the few things that forces us to figure out, what is it that I actually do believe, and who is the God I am calling out to. C.S. Lewis said, second quote here: God whispers to us. You've heard this probably before. God whispers to us in our pleasures, right there. We do find God in our pleasures. We find God in the good gifts He gives us. And He speaks to us in our conscience. Right? We do have questions of, what do I do with the guilt that I feel? But He shouts to us in our pains. It's His megaphone to rouse a deaf world. If He doesn't send storms, it's very rare, if ever, that we actually put our worldview to the test. And so He puts the worldview of these sailors to the test. And for the most part, what they believe in is found wanting, because at the end, what happens is they turn to God and to the Lord, and they offer sacrifices and make vows. Their eyes have been opened to who God is because of this storm. But along the way, it's interesting when you look at verses 12 to 14. Jonah says, how do we solve this? Jonah says, pick me up and hurl me into the sea, then the sea will be quiet for you, for I know it's because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land. We don't like the idea of sacrifice. These men, these sailors, didn't like the idea of, we don't want to sacrifice you. We're going to work hard. We're going to try to get ourselves out of this mess. We're going to do everything that we can by our own works, our own strength, our own wisdom, our own initiative to get out of this mess. And that's like us as well. When we realize there's a mess in our lives, there's a mess between us and God, there's pain, there's a storm upon us, we try to get out of it by ourselves. We try to get out of it with our own wits and wisdom, our own strength, our own redoubling our efforts. I'll live differently, God. Just save me. But it's interesting. It's verse 13. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get to dry land, but they could not. The sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. God was insistent to say, no, I'm not going to let you get out of this yourself, because if you do, you won't see the whole picture of what you need from me. And so they eventually hurl Jonah into the sea, and then the sea is calm. That act of sacrifice, it ties in with the Old Testament's view of sacrifice is what accomplishes to bridge that gap between God and us. But if we look at the whole Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament together as one big book, it's very interesting. Jesus refers to Jonah at least three, if not four different times. And so Jesus wants to put his hand on Jonah and say, you know, this is one big book, and I'm touching back and saying, I'm part of this narrative that Jonah, I'm the climax of this narrative that Jonah also speaks to. And so I think we can think of, how does God deal with the storm of his justice and his graciousness coming together? We can just imagine in heaven God saying, you know, how do we work out justice and graciousness? How do we live out both of these things? And Jesus saying, okay, you can hurl me into the storm of their sin. Right? I'll hurl me into the storm of their rejection from you, their fleeing from you, and I'll take their punishment. I'll take what they deserve and maintain justice. But I'll be the way in which they can graciously come back to you, that we can heal that gap. And so I think this is the last couplet then. I think we see here a God who's very passionate, who's full of an active love, who wants to redeem this world. Right? He's moved by the injustice in Nineveh. He wants redemption there. He wants his peace and his graciousness to pervade that area, and so he's acting. Right? Jonah runs away from him, and he says, no, I'm going after you. My loving kindness refuses to let you run away. So he goes after him. And so there's this passionate love that God has to redeem this world. And it ends up with the sailors testifying to it when 15. So they picked up Jonah and they hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. The sailors show us that the God of the Bible is worthy of sacrifice, right? The God of the Bible is worthy of their attention, their sacrifice, their vows, because he is the one that saved them from this storm. So the storm shows them, the storm really reveals to these sailors who the God of the Bible is, even though they're not Israelites. And so it's God's storms, and yet it's Jesus being thrown into the midst of our storms that shows us it helps us to refine our faith and belief in who God is, and saves us actually from the storm. So we A simple definition of sin is fleeing from God's presence. Simple definition of grace is God going after us when we flee, in spite of the fact that we don't deserve it. But and the ultimate act of grace is Jesus saying, okay, you can hurl me into the storm of human sin, and I will heal it. I'll sacrifice myself so that your justice and your grace can come together. Let's pray. Let's respond to God. Father, thank you for revealing who you are here. Lord, thank you for revealing yourself to these sailors. Thank you for your passionate love that wants to draw them to yourself, wants to draw Jonah to yourself, wants to draw Nineveh to yourself. Lord, I pray that you would open our eyes and let us see you afresh, that you would draw us to yourself, that you would help us to have a full, rich picture of who you are, Father, as you reveal it to us in the Scriptures. Help us to perhaps think about what's the issue here that we need most to strengthen in our faith upon you. And we pray, Lord, for those that are going through storms right now, that you would be near, that you would be at work, growing faith and opening our eyes, that we would walk with you in faithfulness. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.